Welcome to today's edition of Centered, a reasonable conversation about life and faith with your host, Dr. Don Belenis, PhD.
Thanks for listening in. This is actually our inaugural nationwide broadcast on Sirius XM Family Talk, Channel 131. Our program is a production of Centered Incorporated, an independent communications ministry founded in 2007. When we were still limited to local and regional radio, one of our guests paid us a tremendous compliment by saying that our show encourages people to broaden their thinking. We certainly hope you find that to be true. By the way, you can find out all about us and listen to or download our Centered programs on our website, www.centeredonline.org. If you like what you hear, or even if you don't like what you hear, please let me know. My email address is dgb@centeredonline.org, and our toll-free telephone number is 888-628-0823. Our topic and our guests today are particularly fitting, we think, for this Independence Day weekend. Our guest is a former rock drummer, a very serious Christian, a professor of history, and the author of some best-selling books about our history and our government. He's also a frequent commentator on Fox News. But before we begin our conversation, let me, as a retired military chaplain, offer our thanks and our best wishes to all our military personnel and their families. You can be assured of our prayers as you protect our freedoms. To God alone be the glory. And now, the topic of the day. What do you think, as a person of faith, about the Tea Party movement? That's what we're going to talk about today. And our guest is Larry Schweikart. He's the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, A Patriot's History of the United States. And he's the author of 48 Liberal Lies About American History and 7 Events That Made America, America. As an historian, what, in your view, was or is the genesis of this Tea Party movement?
Well, in historical perspective, let's keep in mind that most so-called third parties come about because of grievances with the major parties. Usually, the major parties are not addressing issues that people want to see addressed. You think most especially of the rise of the Republican Party in the 1850s, because neither the Democrats, who were protecting slavery, nor the Whigs, who were ignoring it, wanted to deal with the issue.
Yes.
Same thing with the populists in the late 1800s for slightly, I would say, more selfish reasons. They wanted to inflate the currency. So the specific origin is clearly Rick Santelli's outburst on CNBC Business, where he said, you know, do you want to be paying for your neighbor's mortgage? And this was at the time that TARP had just passed. And there was a lot of controversy about bailing out big banks and especially bailing out people who'd taken on mortgages when they knew they didn't have any ability to pay these mortgages. And they knew they were going to go belly up, and at some place the taxpayer would have to step in and take over. So that's the immediate genesis. I think since then it has grown into a slightly larger, I don't mean numbers-wise, but I mean in terms of its goals and objectives, into a larger movement that is roughly based around the principles of smaller government, less government spending, less intrusion by government into all aspects of our lives, and I think to a large extent, you know, controlling the borders and illegal immigration has become a part of this. Clearly, there are gun owners and gun owner associations affiliated with the Tea Party, but I don't get the sense that it's either the abortion movement or the Second Amendment movement that's driving the Tea Party. It seems to me to be substantially focused on getting government under control, and when you do that, you'll take care of a lot of these other problems.
So how long, and this is not really a fair question, I understand that, but in view of what you have observed, how long do you think, would you predict the Tea Party movement will continue to influence American politics?
Well, historically speaking, the record of third parties is fairly short, anywhere from 5 to 10 years. I think the populists, depending on when you count them as starting last about 10 years. The Republicans, of course, last longer, but they become the second party. So one of two things has to happen. Either the existing party, in this case the Republicans, would have to basically retailor themselves around Tea Party principles, which is very easily done. These are the conservative principles that most Republicans have believed in for the last 30 years. Or, I think as Rush Limbaugh once said, the Republicans would become the third party, and the Tea Party essentially would take over. I don't know if under its own name or if it would just take over under the guise of the Republicans, but you might have a complete shift in terms of what the organization looked like.
Mm-hmm. Was or is the Tea Party, in your view, the movement as it's sort of congealed, is it an accurate reflection of the sensitivities and enthusiasms of America's founders?
Oh, yeah. Certainly it is hitting almost all of the key issues that you would find James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and Franklin and probably even Adams and Washington in the modern Tea Party movement, because government is just absolutely antithetical to every notion they had of a limited government that was responsive to the people and was entirely constrained in its activities by the Constitution. That's clearly not what we have today.
Mm-hmm. So as an historian and as a man of committed faith, Christian faith, what stake, in your view, if any, do Christians have in such political developments as this?
Well, I think always Christians have an obligation to keep government small. We have no example in human history of a large and dominant government that does not in some way interfere with the right of some and often most people to practice their faith. Sooner or later, the government starts telling people what they have to believe. And so, if for no other reason, I would argue that committed Christians should be fully behind the Tea Party movement as a means to limit government and what it's doing. And I don't care why it's doing what it's doing. I don't care that if you think that government should, quote, help the poor. The very fact that you are employing government to do that imperils all the other things that you stand for, whether it should be sanctity of life, whether it should be freedom of religion, freedom of speech. We just saw a news article today that said that Obama wants to create an internet ID. So everybody's going to have their own identification when they log on to the net so that the government can find them. I find that incredibly troubling.
A recent controversy on the popular Fox News program focused on the supposed political leanings of our Lord Jesus Christ if he walked the earth with his disciples today. Now, I think I know the answer to the question, but I'm going to ask you anyway, how would you approach that issue?
Okay, well, you have to realize that now we're in the realm of theology and
yes,
not history or political theory, but I think you have to establish a few things to begin with. I do not agree with the notion that Jesus was poor. He got all his money from the wise men as a child. His parents, being good Jewish parents, saved that and protected that for his mission later in life. I fully believe that when he turned age 30 and began his earthly mission, that he got that gold that had been saved for him all those years to finance what he was going to do for the next 3 years. You have to traipse around the Middle East with 12 grown men. I can tell you from playing in a rock band with just six other grown men, that ain't cheap.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to note, and this, you got to really dig to find this, but you know, Nazareth, which is where Jesus grew up and worked as a carpenter, was a Roman garrison town. And so if the Roman army is the main employer of artisans and carpenters in that town, who do you think that Joseph and son did a lot of their work for? So this notion that Jesus would be some sort of raving leftist is just astounding to me. He never said anything to undercut or undermine the religious Jewish authority. He only enhanced it in many ways. So would he be at the Tea Party? Absolutely. You know, I think that anything that could be done to permit people to worship freely, he certainly would be in favor of, because I think he would think he had the right message and his message would win out.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your soon-to-be-released book, which is What Would the Founders Say? A Patriot's Answers to America's Most Pressing Problems. Now, that book presumes
that what the founders of our republic would say about contemporary developments in our country is not only relevant, but keenly important. Why?
Well, it's not only relevant and important, but let me add that we can discern what they would say about these things. I mean, well, they lived over 200 years ago. Well, that's true, but you can say, what would Washington or Jefferson say about Michelle Obama's attempts to control people's diets? Because it was very clear they didn't let anyone control their diet. They ate what they wanted and what they felt prudent. And Jefferson even once said that, you know, if we let the government, influence our agriculture, pretty soon they're going to be telling us what to eat, which is certainly the way it was. I found some surprising things. Not all of them turned out the way I thought they would. And for me, one of the most surprising elements was all the founders, almost without exception, supported public education. Now, in an age of where our public education system is dismal, and usually anti-patriotic and anti-religious, I found that pretty startling. But the reason you have to find out what they said about public education was that they expected that public education would teach patriotism, and they meant patriotic history, government, basic math, and above all, religion. In fact, the founders supported public education specifically so that schools could teach religion. Now, that's amazing given the comments about separation of church and state and that sort of stuff today. That's the whole reason they back public education.
It is an astounding thing, especially in view of the stridency with which those who seek to interpret that separation clause so broadly opine that there ought to be absolutely no mention, no reference, no anything to religion in our society. And that would have been, in your view, utterly foreign to the founders.
Well, and I think you mentioned the, quote, separation clause, and I think we always need to remind people there is no such clause in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
This was a private letter Jefferson wrote expressing his opinion, not the government's opinion, not even his opinion as president, just his opinion of what the religion, the First Amendment, meant. But certainly most people at that time, and virtually all the founders, except for maybe Madison and Jefferson, agreed that states should have complete authority to determine what religions were practiced in their state, if there was to be any support of a particular religion or not. In other words, the idea was that the federal government should make no law barring freedom of religion or in any way interfering with freedom of religion. It had nothing to do with what the states could do.
Would you, in your own view, would you bring that forward into our day and revolutionize education on the state level?
Well, I would have no problem doing it. I know a lot of my friends, I think even my wife, disagrees on this, but I would have no problem if Utah wants to be a Mormon state. That's the choice of Utah. If Massachusetts wants to be an atheist state, that's their choice. But we have freedom of movement. And so long as you are guaranteed freedom of movement, then there should be competition among the states for all sorts of things, for laws, in terms of marriage, and things like that. I mean, divorce, whatever. Let there be competition among the states, but let the states have the choice. Don't put it on the federal government.
So you would trust the states, in effect, to educate your children about religion?
Yes. If we go back to the founders' beliefs that religion, Christian religion, and again, you got to put it in the context of what they were operating on.
Yes.
The Christian religion was necessary to the formation and establishment and maintenance of the republic. That does not mean that you have the state educate them in Islam or Buddhism or anything else. It means based on those principles, that's what the state was to do.
Speaking again on the founders' views, the real focus of your most recent book, we've talked a bit about education, but would their views as a rule be like on such things as the financial bailouts that have taken place or on health care provision and so on, that their views would be more congruent with what I might characterize as especially evangelical Christian traditions than with the prevailing winds in politics today?
Well, certainly in terms of debt and bailout, we know what they said and we know what they meant, because in 1791-92, there was a financial panic. Very few people know about this. In New York, threatened to undermine the credit of the whole country. And the response by Secretary of the Treasury Hamilton, who is certainly one of the founders, one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, is instructive. Quietly, he asked the Bank of the United States to shore up and support the bank. Now, Bank of the United States was, even though it's called a government bank, it was four-fifths privately owned. He didn't mandate it. He requested it. Publicly, he absolutely refused to bail out William Duer, who was the guy whose shenanigans had caused the collapse in the first place. So the public message that went out was, if you engage in financial shenanigans, you're not going to get bailed out. You're going to fail. Privately, he encouraged the government to try and prevent a panic, but didn't mandate it. And I think that's pretty instructive. Hamilton did not believe in debt, as is widely held up by libertarians. Hamilton's statement that it would be a national blessing has to be put in context. He said, if it is kept manageable, and that means within the context of what he set up with the Bank of the United States, which is paid off in a sinking fund every year so that, in essence, Congress could not issue new debt until it paid off the old debt. The way I like to characterize it is Hamilton wanted to put in the United States an American Express type of credit, whereby you're allowed greater and greater credit, but you have to always pay off your loan at the end of the month, as opposed to the modern-day Congress that has a MasterCard Visa line of credit, which is you just keep on adding to it.
Hmm. What about, I know another topic that you address with regard to the founders' views is the matter of the environment, often fighting words, fighting topic these days. How would you characterize their point of view then and compare it to where we seem to be going today?
Well, the place to start on all of this is not the so-called environment, because the founders didn't have a concept of modern-day environment the way we do. Rather, they had concepts of property.
Yes.
How is property best protected so that it is perpetuated, so that it is not damaged, so that it is fruitful? And clearly that was done by keeping it in the hands of individuals, not the government. Jefferson tailored this magnificent set of articles that were adopted under the Articles of Confederation, in which people could buy dirt cheap land that they had to develop. And everything was based on development, which, of course, is anathema to modern-day environmentalists. But the idea was you didn't get to hold land and just sit on it and keep it vacant because it was not, quote-unquote, productive land. You had to develop it. And that's the whole idea behind property taxes today, is that land shouldn't just sit vacant. It should be used. None of them wanted to destroy lakes or streams or forests. They all believed in replenishing the land, but they all believed that land ought to be moved out of the hands of government as quickly and easily as possible into the hands of individuals.
How would that relate to the commonly held presumption today that the environment is kind of a public trust shared by everyone, even in some cases, even comes down to a communitarian kind of point of view with regard to our natural surroundings?
Well, and that is the kind of socialist Marxist model that, the earth belongs to everyone. It's totally contrary to all Western tradition that says that there are individual holdings that the public is best protected when individuals seek their own interests, and that's balanced off by the competition of all other individuals seeking their interests. This is called the market, and that the market will always arrive at a better solution than any government. And of course, recently we see what happens when you try and put the environment in the hands of government. You end up with massive fraud, such as global warming. There's no doubt anymore that the earth is not warming. And even the global warming lunatics have jumped off that wagon, and now they're onto something called climate change. Rather than just admit they were wrong, they've now gone the other direction. I'm reminded of the Panama Canal, building the Panama Canal. A group of scientists had captured Congress with their ideas that it was not a mosquito that caused or transmitted yellow fever, malaria. It was other causes. And for the longest time, Congress was in bed with these scientists and doctors and prohibited real solution to the mosquito problem, the malaria problem in Panama. Well, we're seeing the same thing with global warming. These guys are implementing policies based on this communitarian view that if the market were left to its own would never have been adopted.
So it all comes down to, I think, especially for Christians, not only individual responsibility, but individual vigilance, does it not?
Absolutely. individual rights, you cannot make communal choices. There's no such thing as a social choice. There's only a choice made by individuals, one after another after another. Everything about the Bible confirms that individuals are to be held accountable, not societies or groups. Yeah, there are examples in the Bible where the tribe of Israel was held accountable for the actions of one, but for the most part, the message of the Bible is that of individual accountability, individual choice, individual salvation. And I don't see how you broaden that to include in so-called environmental rights today that are really socialist.
I appreciate it very much, Larry. Important stuff to think about. And I appreciate your being on our program again.
Sure. Thanks, John.
And to remind everyone, his most recent book is titled, What Would the Founders Say? I recommend it to you for your consideration. And for everyone, please let me know what you think about this and other programs. My email address is dgb@centeredonline.org. This is Don Belenus again with a reflection on our conversation with Larry Schweikart about Christians and their government. God has no party affiliation. This should be patently obvious, and it is absurd to suggest that the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, Jesus, would align himself with a political movement. It is also important to remember that Jesus' coming, his incarnation to this world, took place by God's design in the fullness of time. Yet, during Jesus' entire earthly ministry, he and his fellow Jews were, without interruption, under the cruel boot of the Roman Empire. And finally, as Jesus himself emphasized, his kingdom was not of this world. He was not the leader of some earthly political movement, despite the fact that many of his followers wanted him to do that precisely and lead them politically. But he was rather the only begotten Son of God, who lived among us because of the Father's love for his entire world, not just people of one particular stripe or even of one nation. So what of government? It's an accommodation to our sinful human nature. And as the Apostle Peter, who ministered during a time of horrible, increasing persecution, as he wrote in 1 Peter 2, verse 14, with regard to governors, human government has two essential functions, to punish those who do evil and to praise or commend those who do good. Period. We North Americans are generally proud of our governments, particularly because our freedoms are, to one degree or another, defended and maintained. In the same context, in 1 Peter chapter 2, I quoted a moment ago, the apostle also turns to the subject of freedom when he writes, "Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God." Freedom implies choice, and choices are yours alone. You and I cannot delegate or refer or pass off our moral responsibilities to government, any government. Our lives certainly have a political element. That's inevitable in our time, but neither our ultimate allegiance nor our most basic hope belong to this world. Only Jesus centers us. Only Jesus centers us. Our Centered program is a simple production with a big idea, to encourage you to think critically about a wide variety of subjects and to center your everyday life in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our guests are carefully chosen from among people of extraordinary expertise and experience. We don't always agree with them on every point, but we engage in a sensible and respectful dialogue. Today, everyone knows we are living in troubled times. Christians must think and act with the greatest of care. Our prayer is that our Centered program will not only be of serious interest to you, but that it will be a source of useful information. When you tune in, we'd like you to imagine yourself listening in on an interesting conversation between two new friends. We encourage you to contact us and join in the conversation.
On behalf of our family and our board of directors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for your kind and thoughtful attention.
Yeah, and check out our website.
Remember, it's www.centeredonline.org.